So I'm hoping this will be a fairly short talk, because I'm hoping there'll be time for sort of discussion after it. Which I'd be pleased by, because, you know, if you ask a question, there's a direct link with something you're interested in, you know, through the question and then the discussion. So I'll give a bit of a talk and then we'll see how the time goes. Anyway, this talk, I can't remember the exact title, but it's something like Evolution or Revolution, Evolution or Revolution. But the subtitle, in my mind at least, is like a Buddhist approach to change. A Buddhist approach to change. How to bring change about, if you're a Buddhist. Because I think a lot of people, you know, here, a lot of us, I think, kind of want to change the world for the better. So I'm kind of taking that as given. We want to change the world for the better. That's great. But the question that immediately arises is how to do that. Because I think change, you know, creating change is not easy. And I don't pretend I've got the answers, but it's just like a series of reflections on a Buddhist view of change. And, you know, let alone in here, out in the world, a lot of people want to change the world, often for the better, and that's brilliant. And yet, I mean, I was listening to Satchit this morning in his talk, the world goes on, not obviously getting better, and possibly getting worse in various ways. So change is not guaranteed at all, and change is not easy. So it's well worth reflecting on the process of change as well as the kind of end you want. Yeah. So let's assume we want a better world. The question is, what do you do? First of all, I was just reflecting, what kind of strategies do people have? And I will be honest, I hope she never listens to this. I was thinking about my mum. As you do, you think about your mum. She firmly believes change is impossible. It's just not going to happen. The world is getting worse, quite rapidly. Before long, we'll all be extinct. Nothing you can do about it. Enjoy life while you can. And then, well, that's that. Hey. Which is a definite worldview. It's got consistency. It might even be correct. Who knows? It leaves her, you know, not unhappy, but not exactly happy. But, you know, leading a good life, but not really trying to change anything. You could give up on change at that point. Opposite end of the spectrum is the whole kind of revolution paradigm. Smash the system. Class war. You know, just revolt. Turn it all upside down. Almost by definition, what comes next will be what you want. You know, heaven on earth. Quite a different paradigm, revolution. I'm not going to reflect on all of these, but this usually involves a really clear baddie. It's really clear who's the enemy. You know, smash the enemy, the rest of us are great, and paradise will rapidly dawn. Somewhere in the middle of that, quite a common paradigm, I think, is where you want change, but it all looks too big, a bit scary. You know, how can you possibly change the world? So you kind of retire into a bit of a shell, and you sort out your little bit, which might be really quite small, you know, your personal recycling or, you know, shopping or whatever it is. And do change that, but you just don't kind of look beyond changing, hello, welcome, changing your little world. And I definitely know people, very good people, who do that. I've got a good friend who's mad about recycling. I mean, she really will comb through the bins, picking out scraps of paper and tut-tutting if you haven't recycled this bit of paper in this bag and this bit of plastic in this place and blah blah blah. So she's exemplary on that scale, but not kind of beyond it, if you see what I mean. That's great. The trouble is, some of the problems facing us these days are really our global problems. I mean, climate change is the paradigmatic one. You know, we're talking about the planet and the climate of the planet. And change has to be on that scale to, you know, to change the climate. So I think it's understandable, sorting out your little bit, but it's, unless everybody does it, it's not going to, you know, solve the problem. If everyone did do it, that would be marvellous, fabulous. Okay. Another one is kind of retiring. Just kind of step, do what you can to just step right out of it. kind of adopt a purely spiritual perspective. I'm going to meditate. I'm going to retreat. I'm going to go up a mountain. I'm going to be a yogi. I'm just not going to participate in that dirty system down there, the economy or whatever it is. Which is quite a classic Buddhist thing. You know, Buddhist history is full of people going up mountains to meditate. The one that comes to my mind is Milarepa, or even the Buddha, you know. And the theory there is you go up your mountain, you do retreat, you just take no interest in the world, get enlightened, that's quite important, then you come back down, you know, as an enlightened teacher, and then, fabulous, everyone loves you, and you start a new school of Buddhism or something. Yeah, so that is, you know, time-honoured. The only thing is, I think it's you just can't kind of step out of the system in that way. Even if you go up your mountain, you're going to keep eating, probably. And certainly our retreat centres up mountains are quite dependent on things like supermarkets for their shopping. They really are. You could be, you know, more hardcore. We've got one called Eco Dharma in Spain, which is more hardcore, but I bet they do go shopping sometimes. And most of our retreat centres totally rely on shops, so you can't really step out. There's a lovely little sermon by a guy called Barry Commoner, who says there is no away to throw anything. And it's like there's no away to retreat, unless you step off planet Earth altogether, you know. So looking within, sorting out yourself, getting enlightened is great, but you can't sort of stop participating in the meantime. Okay, another strategy, more or less the last one, is the whole kind of political change route, where you just engage with all the structures of power and administration and society to just change the system, not by violent revolution, but by you know, the kind of democratic social process. And the best example of that I want to talk about more later is a guy called Dr. Ambedkar in India, who was leader of the Untouchables in India, who were about the most discriminated against people you could ever imagine. But he changed the system. He rewrote the constitution to make it illegal to be untouchable, or treated as untouchable. And he embedded all sorts of positive discriminations into the system. And then prejudice was still there, but at least the law was on their side. And once the law was on their side, gradually, you know, they could use the law to advance their case. Brilliant. A long, slow, pretty thankless task of endless meetings and marches and votes and canvassing and all that. Anyway, I'll come back to that a bit. So, quite a few strategies, and I'm sure there's other strategies for change. And all, you know, some success, some not success, some successful in a certain sphere, but not in a global way. So it kind of begs the question, has Buddhism got anything, you know, interesting or useful or constructive to say about change? And I think it's an open topic. I don't pretend I've got the answers. It's more like if I start a debate, I'd be really happy. Yeah. And I do think, well, I think Buddhism is coming to the West. And I feel really happy to be part of, you know, these generations is the generations of Buddhism coming to the West. And as Buddhism comes to a new place, a new culture, or a new time, it's got to kind of transmute a bit to meet the needs of that culture and that time. So Buddhism coming to the West is going to transmute to meet the needs of the West. And I really hope Buddhism, you know, rises to the challenge of meeting the needs of the West, which is this whole business of rampant materialist consumerism, and then, you know, potentially runaway change, ecological, environmental change. So I really hope Buddhism really gets engaged with that and has something to say about that and contributes to the solution. There's a nice little quote by a guy who was around a lot in the 80s or 90s, called Fridtjof Capra, a kind of alternative particle physicist, a very mystical physicist. And I think he said, our version of Buddhism will be environmental awareness. I think that's what he said. I haven't actually looked it up. But that's quite exciting, you know, our version of Buddhism. What will it be? Environmental awareness. So it may or may not be, but it would be great. Anyway, the Buddhist view of change. So first thing is, I think, for Buddhism, change is happening the whole time. Change is completely built in. Change is not something you can sort of switch on and off. Change is permanent. Change just goes on and on and on. We're in the middle of change. And that immediately introduces a certain perspective. I'm talking about impermanence. So impermanence equals change. So the first implication, if everything is changing, is in a sense everything is possible. It's not like we're fixed in a system that's going to roll on forever. Everything changes. So everything more or less is possible within the laws of nature and stuff. I'll come back to a little bit. Everything is possible. So that's very liberating. You can apply it to yourself. You know, you're not stuck as boring old Lokabandhu, boring old Kashti, boring old blah blah blah. You know, you can be pretty much anything, including enlightened. Brilliant. But the second perspective, I think, is equally interesting, is that, everything changes, including your dream. You might achieve your dream, and yet change carries on. Your dream, your paradise on earth, your dream home, your retirement villa, whatever it is, your perfect partnership, etc., carries on changing. So you've got to kind of hold things lightly, because change won't stop, even when you get to where you want to be. The ultimate thing of that, I suppose, is death, mortality. You know, you're going to die sooner or later. So Buddhism says everything is possible, and kind of hold it lightly, because it's going to change. Second thing is that change is not a random thing. It's not like we sort of jump about from this situation to that situation to that situation. Change happens according to all kinds of natural laws that are just built into the fabric of the universe. One natural law is if you throw something up, you know, it goes up, it changes, and then it comes down. The natural law in that case is gravity. Nothing kind of mystical, it's just gravity. If you apply a match to something, it gets hot. Then you take away the match, it gets cold. That's the law of thermodynamics, I suppose, something like that. If you apply sunshine and water to a seed, it'll grow, if you're lucky. That's the law of, I don't know, biology. Anyway, you get the picture. There are lots and lots of natural laws governing change. And change is very complicated, but not random. And what that means for a Buddhist is, as well as holding it lightly and believing in possibilities, your next thing is to kind of learn as much as you can about these natural laws. How does change happen in the sphere that you want to kind of achieve something? And the Buddhist word in this area is skillful, becoming skilled. And rather than talking about being, you know, good or bad, or nice or nasty, or saintly or sinner, Buddhism talks more about being skillful or unskillful. And it just says, become skillful. If you want things to go well in your life, become skilled in that area. And that doesn't guarantee success, it just makes it more likely. So if you're a gardener, and you've got this seed, and you want it to turn into a rose, you know, you learn about roses and seeds and all that, and you apply, I think, horse manure. Roses like horse manure, I think. Anyway, so it doesn't guarantee you get a rose, but it makes it more likely. If it was a cactus, you'd apply sand, I suppose, or something. And, you know, you get the idea. So I love this word, skillful. Become skilled. And it goes right back to the Buddha. He talks about just like fletchers straighten arrows, and carpenters work wood, and, you know, channel water. You know, learn how to do your chosen area. So these natural laws, I think there's millions of them, and they just cover the entire universe, everything. I don't think anything is random, as far as I know, for Buddhism anyway. But there's just different laws in different spheres of life. I could give a whole talk about it, but just very briefly, Buddhism divides it up into five broad categories of phenomena, and the five broad categories of natural law. So one whole thing is about physical stuff, you know, which is gravity. Throw something up, comes down. That's a natural law of solid objects. The next thing would be the whole class of natural laws of biology, you know, molecules, biological molecules doing their thing, germs and amoeba and so on. They're quite a different set of natural laws, biochemistry. Next one would be the natural laws of the mind. If you kind of evolve to living beings, you get minds, psychology, psychiatry, behavioural stuff, all different natural laws. And we're talking about, by this time, we're talking about us, you know, what makes us tick. You might be working with meditation at this point, how to kind of learn how the mind works. So there's natural kind of laws. And a lot of meditation is just learning how to set yourself up so that your meditation is likely to go well. You can't kind of bang yourself over the head and have a good meditation to order. You've got to kind of set it up and it just unfolds. Another natural law is the law of karma. That's a big one for Buddhists and for us. And that's the law of our will. We haven't just got minds and feelings and stuff. We've got a will. And as soon as you start putting your will out to make this happen or make that happen, you get what's called karmic consequences. Basically, I think it means that you become more and more that type of person. So if you habitually have a kind of bad temper, you know, you'll reap the karma of having a bad temper. If you kind of act, you know, you put your will out to act generously, you'll reap the karma of a generous person. So the whole science of karma. Sometimes it gets a little bit mathematical in Buddhism, but I think the principle is you become more of what you will, what you intend. And then there's a final kind of whole category, which is almost like the category of enlightenment or magic. It's a bit hard to talk about, much harder to pin down. But you read about the Buddha and strange things happen around the Buddha. I haven't got any siddhis, which Akashati mentioned, but the Buddha definitely seemed to. So there is a kind of space in the system for, you know, out of the ordinary things to happen, if you like, magic to happen. But none of it's random. It all happens according to natural laws, which we can learn about. So I think what this means is that in life, in the universe, in our world, some things are not possible just because, you know, the natural laws concerned just don't quite permit it. I was thinking of, imagine the floor is really wet for some reason. Sometimes it is in Buddhafield tents. We wanted to meditate hovering 2 foot off the ground. Be very practical, very, you know, dry and convenient. But it's just not possible. It's just not built into the fabric of reality to do that. So forget it. You know, don't go there. But plenty of other stuff is perfectly possible. It's just more likely to happen the way you want it to if you understand the processes that'll give rise to it. And a few years ago, I was I had a kind of favourite Buddha. I don't know how much you guys know about Buddhism, but there's the Buddha who got enlightened all those years ago. And then over the next 2,500 years, Buddhist tradition gave birth to all sorts of other Buddha images. And this is one, a beautiful Tara image. But I had a kind of favourite, which was a Buddha called Amoghasiddhi. And he is depicted, dark green colour, seated in meditation, just deep meditation, just like this, eyes closed, sitting there, in a kind of forest in the north, very kind of dark, secret, mysterious kind of place. And yet, at the same time, he was the Buddha of action and the Buddha of Infallible Success. That's what he was called. And I love that. I really wanted that quality of infallible success. And I think the particular thing that attracted me about him is he was immersed in meditation. And the way I understood it, I hope I got it right, is that because he was so immersed in meditation, he was totally tuned in to the way things are and the kind of flow of cause and effect, you know, around him. And then to bring something about, all he had to do was kind of lift his little finger at the right time. And then just like that, you know, the right thing would happen in the right order, and it would unfold in the way he wished. And the infallible success would manifest. And some people seem to have that gift. In real life, I think I'm more Mr. Busy, 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 Rush, 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 you know, headless chicken type. But I aspire to this mysterious, you know, effortless, infallible success paradigm, where you could just kind of catch somebody's eye and just kind of, you know, they do whatever had to be done and magic. So I took that as a kind of archetype for somebody totally tuned in to the kind of cause, the laws of cause and effect, and the kind of knowledge of how to make something happen. Coming a bit more into, you know, everyday real life, something else I love, but I don't know much about it, but it's here on this site, is permaculture. So, you know, we've got to grow food and eat food, and there's more and more people, and we need more and more food, and bigger and bigger problem. But permaculture just seemed the same principle as applied to food. So you have a piece of land, and you want certain kind of products from it. So you don't just get busy, busy, busy planting and plastering it with chemicals. You get intelligent. You just study your land, you observe it for a year or so, and then you just set it up so that food naturally arises with the minimum of work. And, you know, to me that's just really intelligent use of these natural laws of cause and effect in the realm of food. And what it means is that your solution will be different in every place, because every piece of land is different and every climate is different and so on. So, what I want to do is come on now is to change in the kind of realm of social change. Because when we talk about making the world a better place, quite often we mean, you know, a better human society where we live in a more intelligent, skillful way, and we as a species, you know, do less harm to the planet. So that's in the realm of social change. It includes food and permaculture, for sure. But, And I think this is a particularly difficult realm to achieve change in. Partly because you immediately bump against other people. And you might want to change, and you might know exactly what should be done. But other people, and there's 6 billion of them or so, will have other ideas, and they'll be just as determined, etc., as you. So it's not easy. Not only that, you know, we are part of it. It's not like you can be a kind of observer. You know, we are totally part of any society we're part of. And the bad habits you might see in your society, let's say rampant materialism, are quite likely to be bad habits in your mind too. Just because that's where we've got brought up. And, conditioned. So I think it's about the hardest area to achieve change, and yet necessary. So I thought I'd start off giving a couple of examples, and then pretty much lead into a few very tentative suggestions, but then discussion. Yeah? So my talk kind of peters out at that point, and we'll just see what arises between us. And the examples I thought of, one of them I already mentioned, which is Dr. Ambedkar achieving change in India. So I'll tell the story very briefly, because it's a very inspiring story. And if you're interested in it, I recommend you go to YouTube. Because on YouTube, they recently put a video, over 3 hours long, big long video on YouTube, of Dr. Ambedkar's life story, the whole life story in English, really well done. telling the whole story of what he did. Brilliant movie. I've seen it 4 times. It's fantastic. Anyway, he was active in the first half of the 20th century. Born in 1890-something. Died in 1956. And which was the time that the British Empire was in full swing and then, you know, tipped over into independence for India. So big change for India. Huge change for India. It was the time of Gandhi, you know, agitating for independence. And he was born an untouchable, which literally means you get treated as an untouchable by everybody else in the Hindu caste system who feel it's what you deserve. And you're kind of born there as an untouchable because you did something really bad in a previous life and you're here to be purified, in a sense, by suffering this particular thing. And if you suffer it in silence, you might come back a bit better up the pecking order if you're lucky. So it's a very stable system because it makes it a kind of crime or sin to interfere with it. You're interfering with somebody's purification, for goodness sake. So it's gone along for a good 2,000 years, this the caste system. And these poor people, of whom there were millions and millions and millions, were right down the bottom and treated as untouchables. Anyway, he was born. And the first really, really positive thing that happened to him, almost by fluke, was he got a good education. There was a kind of enlightened Maharaja who were dotted around India at the time. This was the Maharaja of Baroda. Just gave him an education. Fabulous. So he got sent to university in America, university in England, etc. And so his mind was freed by just being in a totally different environment for long enough to be just freed of the conditioning everyone else had. So that's very important, education. He talked about education as tiger's milk. Fabulous little image. And if you drink the milk of a tiger, you grow up a tiger. So education looks like milk, but actually it's tiger's milk. Fabulous. So I think, you know, if we think about ingredients for social change, education is right at the beginning. Especially if it frees your mind to think in a different way. Then he came back, kind of ready to embark on his life's work of working in India, and quickly tried kind of protest actions, a bit Gandhi style, yeah? Gandhi was doing salt marches and stuff at the time. He tried a march to a tank full of water, where they'd historically never been able to drink because they pollute it, but legally they were allowed to drink there, so he thought, okay, let's go and drink from this tank, just because we're allowed to, it's symbolic. And they did, but it just provoked riots, major, major riots by all the caste Hindus, and violence. And he very quickly thought, actually, violence is not a good thing. Violence won't work. Violence breeds violence. You know, there's millions of us, untouchables, but we're outnumbered 10 to 1, so it's just a bad idea. So quite quickly, he didn't exactly retreat, but he kind of stepped into the kind of legal avenues of politicking, just to make sure the law ended up on their side. And his window was that it was a decade or two before the British left India. And he knew he had to get these new laws embedded in the constitution before the British left, because the Hindus never would. So he was basically not an enemy, a kind of opponent of Gandhi. Gandhi wanted independence as quick as possible. Ambedkar wanted human rights first and then independence. So they were kind of rivals. At one point Gandhi went on a hunger fast to the death to defeat something Ambedkar wanted. So they're quite, you know, head to head some of the time. And that itself, you know, threatened to provoke huge riots across India. It's all in this movie, if you watch YouTube. Anyway, to cut a long story short, he was successful. He managed to get a new constitution for India, completely outlawing untouchability and completely enshrining basic human rights for them. Fantastic. And India became independent. And in a sense, the same old prejudices carried on in lots of people's minds, but the law was on their side. So gradually, things shifted. The other thing he did, I'll just mention, backtracking slightly, is that he came back to India kind of liberated to think in a different way. but all his fellow untouchables were still thinking in the same old way. And he started giving all kinds of talks to them, trying to kind of rouse them from their passivity, you know, thinking they deserved it, thinking nothing could change. Because he was one of them, he could get away with it. But he seemed to give really, really almost insulting talks. You know, if you don't stand up, you're useless. What's your life worth unless you stand up and make a protest against your conditioning? You know, you're like sleeping dogs. Get up. And he could kind of get away with it. And he managed to kind of prod them quite aggressively almost into action, but slowly kind of woke them up. So anyway, finally, he got this legal change, that's great, but finally he kind of almost despaired of that at the end of his life, because he just saw how deep the prejudice in everybody's minds were, the caste Hindus. And so very shortly before he died, he kind of took a whole different step of conversion to Buddhism. He just thought, I'm fed up with Hinduism. Hinduism is just not going to change. It's just locked into this system. And he stepped out to become a Buddhist. And because he was such a kind of universally respected leader, I think 3 million of his followers just followed him, just like that. I think it's the biggest mass conversions in history. Ever. And it's sparked off a whole wave of, Buddhist revival in India. I think there's about 80 million Buddhists in India now, all from this kind of wave of new Buddhists. And that's working purely on the mental level. You know, their social, economic, political situation didn't change. In fact, sometimes it got worse. But their mindset changed. They thought, we are free. We are not untouchables anymore. We are not Hindus anymore. We are just, you know, we're reborn, quite literally. So, that's one example. Whether or not you could transpose it to here in other agendas, I don't know. But it's a brilliant example. It's very inspiring. And we have, in Triratna, we've just got a very close connection with that whole community of people, because Sangharakshita, our founder, was around at the time. And he knew Ambedkar. And particularly after Ambedkar died, he was just there. And they were plunged into despair, but Sangharakshita happened to be on the spot. And just built really, really strong links with all those people. It's a whole other talk, really. So the second example I want to give is the Triratna Buddhist community, of which Buddhafield is a part. So Triratna and Buddhafield, you know, want to change the world, want the world to be a better place. And we've got a sort of strategy for doing it, which we don't apply like a formula, and it doesn't. It's a bit early to say if it works yet, but it's a bit of a kind of theory of change. So Satyajit this morning was talking about, the ideal of the Bodhisattva, where you just kind of vow to make the world a better place. But by definition, you might do that, but you're trying to change the world. So the vision we have is, you could talk about it in lots of different ways, but one way is to create a Buddha land, or Buddha field, same thing really. And that's a place where, in this world, in this land, which might be the size of the whole planet, you know, let's think big, all the conditions are the best possible conditions for people to make spiritual progress. That's the kind of Buddhist vision. If you're not a Buddhist, you'd put it somehow differently. But to create a world which is just the best possible conditions for spiritual progress. So this might be a Buddha field in miniature. You know, here we are, no worries about anything, peaceful, quiet, lots of possibilities on offer, best possible conditions to learn about what you choose. Fantastic, this is a mini Buddha field. So that's the mission. The question is, how do you do it in the middle of planet Earth and a materialistic society? This comes very much from the Buddhist tradition, which tends to talk about pure lands. A pure land is a Buddha field. And yeah, the theory is, I'll just tell you briefly, and then maybe we'll discuss it as we go, is tends to start off with a person, or maybe a small group of people, who are absolutely passionate. That's what they want. It might be a bodhisattva taking their bodhisattva vow to create this Buddha land or Buddha field. So you've got to start off with a huge amount of passion to make it happen. Yes. Secondly, that person, or that group of people, that bodhisattva, has to have incredibly strong personal spiritual practice. So a lot of Satchitit's talk this morning was about the six perfections, which are the six kind of qualities you'd perfect yourself. One way of doing that is to kind of take a bit of time out and go up the mountain, get yourself enlightened, perfect your perfections, and come back. But another way to do it is just work on them as you're working in the world, if you see what I mean. But the point about the perfections, or one point about them, is that once you've mastered them, they're kind of part of you. And in a sense, they become effortless. It's just totally natural for you to be that way. To be energetic, to be inspired, to be patient, to be generous, to be whatever. So it's kind of effortless. And if you're going to change the world, you need that kind of effortless quality just to keep going. So I think it's not optional. You need your perfections if you're going to not run out of steam in no time at all. Now, a few years ago, slight digression, I spent a lot of time going around other alternative, you know, radical groups. Some of them were incredibly heroic, you know, living in tree houses in the woods to stop trees that bypasses being built. But I came to realise often the life cycle of your typical protester could be really short. You have a brief, glorious, you know, moment of heroism, and then you're completely burned out and just fed up with the whole business, and off you go and get married or something. And you'll never change the world really that way. You've got to kind of find a way to do it for life, and then for life after life after life. And these perfections are crucial, I think, because it sort of makes it effortless. Yeah. Then the next thing they do, or we do in Triratna, I think, is start building a little community of like-minded people. So even if it starts off with one person, it's got to quite quickly become more than one. They're real buddies. And I was thinking about Amoghasiddhi, I mentioned before, the Buddha of infallible success. As that branch of Buddhism developed, these Buddhas appeared, sort of out of the archetypal imagination of meditators, I suppose. But they quickly became Buddha families. So if you look at Amoghasiddhi, you get Amoghasiddhi's Buddha family. It's called a karma family. It's the family of action. And it includes Tara, as it happens, and various others. So you can see that same principle. You get a little Buddha family. It's not just you anymore. As quick as possible, it's got to be others. But totally sharing your values, almost like of one mind. And then the next thing is to make that mini community kind of bigger and bigger. And the way our kind of model for it is to have a little kind of oasis of a new society, of Buddha land or Buddha field, whatever you want to call it, in which you can live and sort of exemplify what you want to exemplify, and into which you can invite others. So the important things are exemplification of your values, be the change. You can't just smash the system, you've got to be the new thing, whatever it is. And you've got to have bridges coming into your community, which is really easy for people to walk over and come into. So if you take Buddhafield as an example, you know, I think Buddhafield people really do try and exemplify their values. We're not perfect, but we do our best. And, you know, every event like this is a bridge for new people to come in and just, you know, see the thing and join it if they want to. So that's very important. And then, in a sense, for me at least, there's not a huge amount you can do beyond that. You just have to kind of have faith that your values resonate with others. It's like we all, you know, what do we want? We want the world to be a better place, really. Who wants the world to be a worse place? So you can't force anyone to do anything, You can just hope that there's a resonance happens, and then you know, if the resonance happens and people see a bridge to walk over into the community, there's a good chance they will. And I think that's about as far as we've got in the kind of theory of social change. Is start off with your nucleus of your community, exemplify it, make it a bit bigger, have bridges into it, and then sort of trust that, you know, people will respond. And I think that's what all our Triratna Buddhist centres are trying to do, of which Buddhafield is one. They're trying to be little oases of a different way of living and being, whether they're in Manchester or Glasgow or the slums of India or here or whatever. It's the same principle. But part of that, I think it's worth mentioning, is any community has boundaries. It's got a definite kind of inside and outside. And that can be slightly unpopular these days because we're all one and, you know, nobody should be excluded. And yet, if you want to exemplify something, not everybody does, do they? So you've got to be quite clear who is really part of your community. You can have the bridges and people visiting, but you've got to be clear who's a member of the community. And that's quite a painful lesson to learn, because if you get it wrong, it's usually a lot of trouble to sort it out. So what we have in Triratna is an order, a Buddhist order, the Triratna Buddhist Order, which I suppose is that kind of core community, which has got a really clear boundary. And frankly, we make it difficult for people to join. We do make it difficult for people to join, because we want to be really clear people are of the same mind before they do join. So if you want to join the order, in principle we'd love everybody to, but in practice it's a good 5 years waiting and training and befriending and retreating and studying and whatever. And even then, it might be 10 years. Quite often it's 10 years before people get to join. But when people join, there's such a strong confidence that, you know, this new person, man or woman, is kind of the same mind as me. It's magic. I love it. So the order is about 1,800 people now. There's not 6 billion on the planet. We've got 1,800 fully joined the order. We've got a long way to go. But there does seem something kind of magic about the order for me. Yes, and 2 Buddhafield people are kind of off at the moment on ordination retreats. One of them's supporting it, Mamukshu, and one of them's joining the order, Sean. So that's great. They'll come back, well, Sean will come back ordained, and Mamukshu will come back having supported their enterprise. So, this is nearly the end. I think there's a lot more you could say about creating community. It's a bit of another talk, really. But for us, exemplification is crucial, boundaries are crucial, and bridges into it are crucial. And then faith, I suppose. I've mentioned that already. Just trusting there'll be a resonance. Oh, yes. I was going to end with a reading, actually. I've got a magic gadget that Cassidy mentioned. It's not that magic, it's just a Kindle. But I've put lots of readings on it. And this is a reading we do use quite a lot in Triratna. It's by Goethe, I think. German guy, Goethe, philosopher. But it's just about commitment and the kind of energy it takes to make something, to start something. But how there can be a kind of touch of magic in that process if you put yourself out there and say, I'm going to do this. You know, slightly magical things happen. Not random things, according to all these laws of effect, cause and effect I've mentioned, but yeah, I'll read it anyway and then finish and then just see what kind of discussion we want. So he says, until one is committed, there's always hesitancy, always the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. But concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans, which is the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. At that point, all sorts of things occur to help that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from that decision, raising to one's favour all manner of unforeseen accidents and meetings and material assistance, which no man could have dreamed would come his way. Whatever you can do, or dream you can do, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. Begin it now.